Wonderscope Children's Museum is the latest metro institution to break ground on a new location in South Kansas City. In the last few years, the part of town where Bannister Mall once had to close seems to be attracting a new kind of attention. A new Cerner campus, the expansion of Burns and Mac, and a revamping of the old Redbridge Shopping Center all speak to a reimagining of the area, even though pockets of South Kansas City feel totally frozen in time. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, what's going on in South Kansas City? Call 816-235-2888 if you are a part of that community or a part of that change. What are you seeing and what do you want the rest of the city to know? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman here with John Sharp. He's lived in the area for 51 years. He used to be a city councilman for the district, and now he's a columnist for the Martin City Telegraph. That's a community newspaper serving South Kansas City. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you, Gina?
Good. You know, first of all, just what is South Kansas City exactly?
Well, there is no exactly to it because everybody has a little different view on what is South Kansas City. I'd say on the north end, the most expansive view would take it up around 63rd Street. Some people would put the northern boundary a little south of that. And, of course, Kansas City goes into Cass County, and we have a lot of farmland in Kansas City, Missouri.
Within the boundaries of what you would personally consider South Kansas City, there's farmland?
Oh, yes. If you're in Cass County in Kansas City, I'd say that's pretty South Kansas City. And it really goes from state line over to the Lee Summit boundary on the east.
You seem to really have a passion for this part of town. I mean, you've lived there a long time. You've represented it in city government. You write about the community's concerns in your columns. Talk to me about your feelings for South Kansas City.
Well, I've just lived there, as you mentioned, for 51 years, and I served as a state legislator from the Ruskin-Hickman Mills area. I served on that school board in Hickman Mills for a couple of terms, and, you know, my children, I went through the Hickman Mills School District, so I do feel very attached to it, and it's a lovely area with a lot of great people. We've had some tough times with the closing of the mall, and it did seem to many of us that we were kind of forgotten about and neglected out there, but that's sure changed recently. We are really doing great on attracting new businesses and jobs. Now, we do have to, in my opinion, attract more new housing and refurbish a lot of the housing stock we have. But as far as jobs and business growth and including retail growth, you know, we're doing great.
Well, so can you tell me a little bit more about the history of just there even being a part of town known as South Kansas City? Because it is sort of a nebulous region with not clear boundaries, but there's a South Kansas City Chamber of Commerce that goes all the way back to 1931. So the idea of this being an area, a large area, it sounds like, with shared interests and something that brings everyone together, that goes way, way back.
Well, and a lot of that deals with the school districts out there because the school districts were there before it was annexed into Kansas City. Much of that annexation took place just before I moved there. So it's been a while. But the Hickman Mills School District was already there, Center School District, and the school district boundaries don't coincide with city boundaries. In other words, the Hickman Mills School District has part of Grandview, although most of it's in Kansas City. The Grandview School District has part of Kansas City, although most of it's in Grandview. But a lot of people out there identify with the school districts because that's what's really held the communities together out there.
We're going to get more into our conversation in just a moment, but I want to turn to one of our callers at 816-235-2888. Andrew in South Kansas City has been watching some of the change in the neighborhood lately. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good. How about you? What do you want to share?
I'm an electrician that I worked on the first two Cerner towers that went up. So I was there for about 2 years, and I'm just starting on the next two towers, so I'll be there for probably another 2 years. I just wanted to say, like, the commercial development that I've seen out on Bannister Road it's pretty amazing to see some of these old Lowe's and Kmart's and stuff that was just sitting there vacant, like, bringing back to life. I mean, it's you can definitely see a change happening there, and I think Cerner's a big part of that.
Do you see the change in more than construction? Like, do you notice it in people, or, you know, just is there a different vibe?
I guess, yeah, a little bit. I mean, the area seems to be improving. And not only that, but like rentals and places like that, landlords seem to be buying places and taking better care of them because it looks like they're renting to a different kind of person, if you know what I mean.
No, I don't, actually. Can you tell me what you mean?
Well, I don't know. That area seems to have brought higher wages with jobs. So, I mean, it just seems to be a different kind of person that they're marketing these rentals to.
So, like, more affluent?
Affluent, yeah.
Okay, well, Andrew, thanks for that call.
Yeah, thanks.
So, John, tell me, how do you respond to what you're hearing from Andrew about that Bannister Road development in particular?
Well, the Cerner project has been a great incentive for other investments in the area, and it just turned that whole area around, because before Cerner, Bannister Mall was closed, Bannister Square was closed. You could have filmed a disaster movie there. Like, this is the aftermath of World War III, and you really wouldn't have had to bring in any props because it was just sitting there decaying, boarded up, and it was blighting the image of the whole area, because you could see it every time you drove by on I-435. But Cerner, of course, has finished its first four buildings, two office towers and two buildings that weren't as high, connecting those. And they're about to start on the next two towers, which will be just south of the existing ones that will connect to it. And one of those will be 9 stories, one will be 12 stories. But they've already got approximately 3,000 highly paid employees there at their innovations campus in the towers that are already through. And there'll be about 3,000 more on the towers that should start construction very soon. They've already been doing the grading work on that. But it's not just Cerner. There are a lot of other developments out there. If you drive on 71 Highway and you look to the east, about 87th Street, you'll see Boulevard Breweries National Distribution Center there up on a hill. That's a development by North Point Development. Hy-Vee is bringing in a distribution center. So they've got 1,000 to 2,000 employees that will be right there on the south side of 87th. And those, you won't need a computer science degree to work in a lot of those companies that are located there. So those jobs will be jobs that a lot of people that have been living around there can fill. But it's not just North Point. It's the Three Trails Industrial Park is what they call that, or Cerner. But there's so many other things going on out there, too. Burns & McDonald is expanding. The old Bannister Federal Complex on the north side of Bannister Road and just east of Troost, which used to be fully occupied by different federal agencies. Those agencies have moved out to a location on Botts Road, which is still in South Kansas City. But now that those buildings that were built back in the 40s are being demolished, that's already started. That site's going to be cleaned up. It has extensive contamination there, both in the buildings and in the ground, but that's going to be totally cleaned up, and that will be redeveloped as an industrial park with some retail probably outside the flood wall on the east side of Troost. So all of that just along the Bannister Corridor, and now it is leading to more spin-off development. There are several luxury townhouses and apartments that are being proposed just south of the Cerner campus, where basically you could walk to the campus. The old Kmart there is being renovated. That's going to be climate-controlled inside storage with also retail there as well.
Is there some active effort going on, some organized effort to attract all this attention, or has it happened organically?
Well, I think a little of both. The South Kansas City Chamber and the South Kansas City Alliance, and I serve as government affairs chair for that group, have done a lot to promote the area. The South Kansas City Alliance, with the cooperation of Cerner, did a survey of their employees to ask them what kind of housing they'd like in the area so they wouldn't have to drive from 30 minutes away to come to work, and what kind of retail services they'd use. And we got a very good feedback, and it was just like a roadmap to developers on what kind of retail would be successful out there, what kind of housing they'd like. And the developer that's developing these townhouses and luxury apartments just south of there, it's, I'm sure he read it, because what he's developing is exactly what they said they wanted.
You know, taking the long view, is gentrification something you'd worry about in South Kansas City?
I think we've got a long ways to go before we have to worry about that. But I think we are attracting more younger families, and we want to attract many of the Cerner employees. A lot of the homes that in my neighborhood that have been vacant for a long while.
What neighborhood is that?
I live in the Avalon View area, but I could walk to the Cerner campus from where I live. A lot of them are being renovated now, and people are moving into them. So that's a good sign. And then as you go further west in South Kansas City, I mentioned the Burns and McDonald expansion in Martin City. Martin City's been a great success story. That's a little ways out south. It's 135th Street. But they have a lot of restaurant bars, a lot of entertainment venues, and Fishtech has opened its new headquarters there. It's a cybersecurity company, and as soon as they finish the first headquarters, they already started building a second building just as big right to the north of it. And those are all very high-paying jobs.
You know, I grew up in the 80s, and you know, I grew up going to movies at Red Bridge Mall and hitting the arcade at Bannister Mall, and that's... I feel, and it's hard to judge your observations from when you were a kid, but that, looking back, I feel like that must have been some kind of a boom time for that area. Would you agree with that assessment, having witnessed it as a grown-up?
Well, it certainly was, and Redbridge Shopping Center, that's where I used to go to the movies a lot because I wasn't always the oldest guy in there. But that shopping center really had kind of deteriorated. It had a high rate of vacancies. It wasn't being kept up. And it has totally turned around because we just had the opening of Blue Moose Bar and Grill, which is very nice, upscale, casual
but
restaurant.
Take me back to what happened between these two things because, you know, there was an emptying out, or at least there seemed to be in some ways in the early 2000s. Maybe it started in the 90s. I don't know.
Well, there was an emptying out at Bannister Mall. They that was not very well managed, in my opinion. And there were concerns about crime at that mall, although I shopped there the whole time it was open, and I never was worried about it. But they didn't do a very good job of handling their public relations, because if there was a shooting a mile or two away, it was reported in the media as near Bannister Mall. And then they put up these guard shacks in the parking lots for their security. So it looked kind of like a minimum security prison. And the image was just much worse than the reality. But we've really seen that area turn around, and Redbridge Shopping Center is just going great guns. It's almost fully occupied now.
Well, call 816-235-2888 to tell us what you're noticing about life in South Kansas City, from hidden gems to neighborhood issues to change, change right now, change in recent decades. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the identity of South Kansas City, a part of town with lots of old neighborhoods that might be changing. My guest is John Sharp, former city councilman, longtime resident, and currently a columnist for the Martin City Telegraph. Hi again, John.
Hi, how are you, Gina?
Great. You know, you're welcome to chime in on this conversation at 816-235-2888. We were just talking about Bannister Mall as this place where, I don't know, like the change that hit that one mall had such giant reverberations throughout South Kansas City, especially the immediately surrounding area. But you had said earlier that there was a period where if you had done, you know, an apocalyptic movie about World War III, that you would have been able to film it there without props. Can you tell me a little bit more about that time period?
Well, that was probably the low point for our community. And when the mall closed, because it was so visible, it had a broader impact on the image of our community. It wasn't tucked away on a dead-end street somewhere. And that really affected people's views of our community. And quite frankly, it depressed a lot of us. But originally, we were going to have a soccer stadium there. And then some folks who didn't live in the area launched a petition drive to try to overturn the city council approval of that. They never got any signatures. They just got a handful. But they held up the project long enough for Kansas to basically steal the soccer stadium, because Kansas has so many more economic development incentives than Missouri does. They basically built the whole stadium and all the infrastructure for it in Western Wyandotte County. So that really postponed the redevelopment of that area for 10 years. There was a 10-year gap between when that was supposed to start and when we got the new Cerner project. But what we've gotten, I think, will have even a greater impact, greater positive impact on our community, but it did hold it up for 10 years.
And so right now, I mean, the big news is Wonderscope Children's Museum eventually moving to South Kansas City, that they've just had their groundbreaking for the construction of that new facility. And then also, you know, the redevelopment of Red Bridge Mall.
Well, that's right. Red Bridge Shopping Center was mainly vacant. And
I'm still using the old terminology from my childhood. Forgive me. Red Bridge Shopping Center.
That's okay. But and it had not been maintained. But we did have new ownership of that center. Lane 4 Property Group bought it. They made significant investments in it. And we attracted Houston's Hardware back there. So they have a full-service hardware store. Then Crow's Coffee just opened up their third facility.
Just this weekend, right?
That's right. Friday, they had their ribbon cutting, and they were open Saturday. And the day of their ribbon cutting, they had more people at that Crow's location than were at their other two in Waldo and near UMKC. And it was just by word of mouth. And again, it was packed Saturday. Blue Moose Bar and Grill, which is, I thought it was kind of a sports bar, but really it's upscale casual. It has a very good menu, but reasonably priced.
But, you know, okay, so getting beyond commercial development, you know, we had this caller earlier who was talking about landlords treating their properties differently, maybe marketing to a different kind of resident. Are you seeing new, like, population growth in the area? Are you seeing people moving to South Kansas City? What's changing maybe in that real estate picture?
Well, we're starting to see that. As I mentioned, some of the homes in my neighborhood that have been vacant for a long time are being renovated and attracting new residents. And I think the regrowth of jobs and commercial investment in the area will attract even more employees, because nobody wants to drive clear across town to go to work. And Wonderscope Children's Museum will be a world-class museum that will see construction starting this summer. Right now, it's located in a renovated schoolhouse in Shawnee, Kansas. Basically, you can't get there from anywhere, or you can't get there easily. And this will be right off the interstate. They estimate that will attract 100,000 to 200,000 visitors from throughout the region their first year in operation. That will be a great help to the other businesses in the shopping center, but it'll also bring more residents to South Kansas City.
What would you say, though, about things like, you know, let's talk about crime, because this time, not quite, I mean, early summer last year, so it's coming up on a year since the slayings along the Indian Creek Trail, and that was not great PR for your area. I'll put it that way.
Well, slayings on a trail by a serial killer can happen anywhere, but the alleged suspect has been arrested and charged on that, and the police responded very aggressively to try to solve those crimes. We have had some crime issues, particularly in the eastern part of South Kansas City. But the Kansas City No Violence Alliance has really made that a target area. And they have identified the small number of people that have been involved in a large percentage of the crime, and they have told, and those people know they've been identified, and the police have made it clear to them that the full weight of the law will come down on them if they continue their activities. But they've also made available social services to try to help them straighten their lives out. We've got a new facility called Hope Hangout in the Ruskin community that really works with at-risk youth to help make sure they stay on the right track. So I think we're dealing with that, and we're dealing with it effectively.
Let's talk to Christina in South Kansas City. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Christina. Sorry.
They rhyme. Our names rhyme. I understand.
Yeah, what's up?
Not much. What do you want to share with us?
Well, I wanted to talk about the natural resources in South Kansas City and what we can do to protect the large portion of trees in the 6th District.
Explain more the nature of your concern. I'm not sure that this is a concern and story that all of our listeners have followed or are even aware of.
So apparently the 6th District has a really large park land, resource, and it's as large as north of the river near Lake Parkville, and it's something that could be a great benefit to the community. Like, there could be more bike paths and things like that.
John, is this something that you've heard people talking about?
Well, people are very interested in preserving the natural beauty and the history of South Kansas City. As you may know or may not know, this is one of the only area in the whole U.S. where the three frontier trails all were linked together, running through that part of the town. It started from the landing on the Missouri River in Sugar Creek, going through Independence, Raytown, through South Kansas City, and then going to Gardner, Kansas, where the trails diverged. And there is an effort by the National Park Service, working with the Mid-America Regional Council. They have developed a concept for reconstructing that 46 miles of trail routes. And some of those segments already have been reconstructed, including in South Kansas City. But we've got a segment here, a segment there. We need to connect the dots. And that's going to be a high priority for us, because we think that will be a great amenity for our residents, but it will also attract tourists from around the country.
Do you have a sense of there being an identity in South Kansas City? Something that people are attached to and see as part of, personally reflecting them and who they are or where they grew up, that kind of thing.
Well, I think that's one of the things we've tried to do as the South Kansas City Alliance. We've tried to be a voice for all of South Kansas City, although I think people tend to identify a little more with their school districts out there, because those have been there for so long. But they also identify with their neighborhoods, their homes associations, and where they go to shop. Like, a lot of people fondly remembered going to Redbridge Shopping Center and are just ecstatic about being able to go there again. When Blue Moose Bar and Grill had a soft opening St. Patrick's Day, they didn't even advertise it. And 2 hours after it opened, there was already a 40-minute wait to get in, and it was a big restaurant. We're seeing the restaurant pavilion at Ward Parkway Shopping Center being a great community draw. So these areas are rebirthing.
We're going to keep talking about it, too. John Sharp, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John is a columnist for the Martin City Telegraph. He used to represent the 6th District in City Council. Up next, there's a romance writing convention in Kansas City. We'll chat with one of the authors, who's kind of a big deal. She's broken some of the rules about race in the genre. Meet Alicia Rye in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. My next guest is Alicia Rye. She's the author of romance novels, Hate to Want You, Hurts to Love You, Wrong to Need You. They are all steamy stories that include interracial courtship and love, and her handling of cross-cultural romance has gotten her a lot of attention. She's on her way to town for the KC KissCon this coming weekend, and she's with us now. Hi, Alicia.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
So first of all, how did you personally get into romance novels?
So I think, you know, it's funny because I read some statistic that said a lot of romance readers start like under 17, like 70% or something like that. And I was no different. I was like 13 years old walking through the library and I saw a cover with some half naked people on it. And for a 13-year-old, that's like catnip. So I was like, yes. And so I picked it up and, you know, and then the rest was kind of history. I mean, I was a voracious reader. I was very shy and introverted. So romance novels really were, you know, and especially when it came to sort of romantic relationships, I was pretty hopeless. So at the time, you know, it's kind of a very, very, you know, scared of boys type of teenager. And so they really became, you know, my framework for learning about, you know, relationships and love and all sorts of things. So
do you think that the lessons you learned, I mean, did you find them helpful when when the time came to employ some actual information in your life?
You know, they did. And it's sort of because, you know, my family didn't, you know, we didn't really talk about, you know, dating or love or sex or anything. And so, yeah, they really were like, you know, there's a book called Everything I, you know I Learned from Romance Novels, written by a popular blogger. And that was sort of how it was for me, where I was like, okay, like, this is what consent means. This is what respect is. Like, this is what I should be looking for. And, you know, very realistic sort of standards of you know, people being kind to each other and being good to your partners. You know, I learned it from there and I deployed it when I needed to and when I found out
so
how to do it.
That is interesting, though, that you feel like those were positive lessons when it comes to things like consent and all of that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, romance, I think, you know, those romance novel covers of yore with Fabio and with, you know, someone, you know, being thrown over a horse or whatever. And sometimes there were like sort of iffy consent scenes. And I think that's sort of what's been absorbed by a lot of mainstream culture is what romance novels are. But, you know, I was reading in the 90s and there were so many great examples of books that were rich with consent, that were wonderfully, you know, empowering for women, for the women characters in it. And so, yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, I had to absorb all of that from somewhere. And I think romance was just such a healthier way, and at least the romances I read, you know, and I'm not saying that all romances even today are at that standard, but like, you know, the ones I read were really fabulous at sort of teaching me, you know, this is what respect looks like, or this is what, you know, a consensual sexual relationship looks like, or whatever it might be.
Can you, you know, obviously, you know, we're on daytime public radio, but
oh, sure.
I wonder if there is just a particular story that has stuck with you as representing, like, man, I learned a great lesson from that story.
Oh, gosh. So many, right? And that's the great thing about romance, is because it's so wide and varied that, you know, there's a different sort of subgenre for everyone. I would say the ones that I read when I was young, one of my favorite ones was it was an older one. It was called Ravished by Amanda Quick, and I just remember the heroine of it loves dinosaurs. Like, it was a historical romance, and so she was sort of an early paleontologist, and it was very great. And it was one of the things I loved was because I was shy and nerdy and I loved dinosaurs. So I mean, you know, you can kind of see yourself in ways. And then and in sort of a different angle, when I was in college or so, I picked up a Beverly Jenkins book, and it was the first time I'd seen sort of non-white characters also finding love and you know, having that same level of living happily ever after and having, you know, respectful relationships and consensual relationships. And, you know, I hadn't really seen that in romance before. So, like, in very different ways, I think every romance has kind of taught me, or the, you know, the ones that are sort of on my keeper shelf, as we call it, the ones that you read until, you know, and you have memories attached to them and stuff, you know, they've all sort of taught me something and you know, very valuable, like any form of literature.
But that brings up the question, you know, what inspired you to take on race in the romance genre?
Well, you know, I am a woman of color and, you know, and like I said, it wasn't a case when you're a woman of color, especially, I think you're from the time you're young, you're kind of taught in America, at least to, you know, you learn to relate in ways that are sort of different from color. Like, you know, I learned with Ravished, I was like, oh my gosh, like, I want to be a paleontologist. You know, this is so cool. Like, I relate to this heroine, even though she wasn't the same color as me. But in another way, it really does sort of internalize the idea that, you know, maybe you won't always, like, maybe that happily ever after, because that's sort of what romance is about, right? Is finding that, you know, happy relationship. Maybe that's not for you, or maybe you can't write it. And when I was in college, my roommate actually was Jamaican, and we shared this love of romance novels. Like, we would, and it was always like very low key because we didn't talk about it. We would just sort of, I'd notice like somehow my books would shrink and then they'd come back, and her books would shrink and then they'd come back. But she had that Beverly Jenkins book, and I was like, can I read that? Let me see. And I didn't believe it at first, but it was like, I think the first moment that I had that realization, like, oh, like, I could do this, like, and I'm not, you know, I'm not African American. Beverly, you know, Miss Jenkins is, and her characters are mostly African American. But it didn't matter, because for the first time, I was like, oh, like, this is possible. I could be an author. I could write this, like, and I could write it. You know, I could write the world as I see it, and the world as I've seen it has always been very rich. You know, it's not a question of, you know, for me, for like shoehorning diversity in or anything. It's just reflecting reality, and my reality is one that's pretty, you know, inclusive and open.
Do you mind, I mean, telling me how you personally identify in terms of like race and ethnicity?
I'm South Asian. I'm Indian. But I was, you know, born here.
So, I mean, when you talk about taking on race, not just in your characters, but also as changing the picture of who is a romance novelist. What's that been like?
It's been very challenging. I'd love to say it's been great and fun and easy. My first book came out in 2009. And so I'm a bit tired now, and I'm young, but I'm tired. And so I'm just kind of waiting for the next generation now to help me out now.
What's been tough about it? What's been tiring?
So when I first started, and the industry has changed drastically since I started. I mean, when I started, you know, it was very hard to get even, you know, I was told you should change your name. You should change the ethnicity of your characters. It's not going to be relatable. It's not going to be, you know, nobody will pick it up. And that was like, you know, what, 9 years ago, 8 years ago? It wasn't that long ago.
That's such a strange idea, though. Like, not relatable to whom?
I don't know. And I just thought, you know, all my life, I've been told to relate to everybody and to relate particularly to the dominant narrative. So, yeah, it was, but that was just the idea, right? And it's still sort of, you know, we see it a lot where, you know, I hear other authors, and I haven't really had this experience, but I know other authors of color have been told, you know, don't put characters of color on your books, or, you know, don't put it in the blurb, or, you know, whatever, because that won't sell books. And I just think, well, they're wrong. And they're severely misunderstanding who the audience is. Because we have some, I don't know what this idea is, that the audience is not hungry for it. And I found it to be just the opposite. So, you know, it's been challenging and it's been exhausting. I mean, for a while there, you know, I couldn't do it. And like, they wouldn't let us be on any panels, but diversity panels, it felt like, you know, that's sort of where we were pigeonholed. And it's only recently that we've sort of gotten this like the ability to say, okay, well, we're going to diversify all of our panels, or, you know, like, you know, conferences have started doing that, and it feels really good because, you know, those aren't like our skin color isn't really the only thing we can speak to. We are also creatives, and we're artists, and we're good at our craft. And so we should be able to speak to those things as well.
But speaking of that, it is interesting to me. I mean, in writing, as opposed to like film or television, you know, on TV, you don't have to tell your viewers what race someone is. They can just see that from the second a character appears on screen. You just have words on a page. And I'm curious about how you communicate your character's race, your character's identity, in a way that is both very like crystal clear and also, you know, doesn't offend, doesn't rub people the wrong way.
You know, and there are ways. I was talking to somebody about this, and my sort of standard is, you know, if my book is made into a movie or a TV show or something like that, do I want fans to ever have the ability to say, no, that person that you cast, you know, like in the book they were white, or in the book they were, you know, this. Like, it should be very clear what the ethnicity is. And I do, you know, I can just say it and it's fine. You know, I was talking to another author about this. We were having a discussion and I said, you know, sometimes people don't like, you know, their skin color being compared to food, saying they're caramel or coffee or whatever, because
yeah,
go ahead.
That is something that I've noticed you actually do. You don't shy away from that.
No. And so I don't, you know, I think, and the author said, well, there's no really other way to say brown because you can't say brown because it's ugly. And I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach a little bit. And I was like, brown is not ugly. Brown is, you know, like if you think that brown is ugly, that's sort of like just the word itself, like you think it's, you know, seeing the word brown is like a bad word or something, that sort of says something about what value connotations you add. And for in romance for a long time, you know, there's been a rich history of sort of, you know, discussions of pale skin and fair limbs and all of this. Like, we don't shy away from describing whiteness, and we think it's beautiful. You know, we say pale or whatever, and that's like a good thing. And so,
like, who,
you know,
is the fairest of them
who
all?
Like, we sort of elevate words for whiteness, and we seem to disparage when we say, you know, just even if you say light brown or dark brown or something like that. And I see nothing wrong with saying that. Like, you know, if somebody, like, I consider myself brown, that's my skin color. And so I use it, or I'll use tan. There's a lot of different words that you can use for colors, for different colors of skin, you know. And so I think it's fine to use those words and to, you know, in after I had that book, actually, I was writing a book at the time with a South Asian heroine and a Jamaican hero. And I sort of went, you know, every moment where I could, I sort of used the words that have been traditionally kind of used for white skin or pale skin or fair skin or whatever. And I made sure, like, to use those just as lovingly for dark skin, because I think it's really important.
Is there a word that, is there an example of that kind of word?
I mean, I think it's just sort of in the phrasing, but I will, I mean, I just use brown, and I love it. Like, I love using that word. And I think, you know, using, there's, you know, if you look open up a Crayola box, there's like a million different words for brown, right? And you can pick out the ones that you love the most. There's actually a great resource. I'll tweet it after this, and but it's like a post about like different words that you can, you know, different sort of good words that you can use to describe various skin colors. And I like that one a lot. But it's, you know, it's...
But it's true
that
it's
important to elevate it.
I never really thought about this before, but it's true that in sort of like steamier writing and those kinds of passages in any kind of literature, skin is usually described in a lot of detail, just no matter what. That's part of that kind of writing.
I think it's like a sensual thing, right? Because it's touch in a way, you know, it's sight and it's touch and it's feel. So, yeah, you do end up talking about skin color, or like different, you know, body parts or whatever. But it's usually very much sort of you know, traditionally sort of it's been viewed in that white dominant narrative. And so I think it is important to, you know, make sure that everyone sort of gets that love a little bit.
You do write about intercultural relationships, and sometimes that's interracial, but sometimes it's more nuanced than just that. And I wonder if you feel like that is as groundbreaking as the sort of attention you're getting for it implies. Like, it's 2018, and like some people might think, yeah, that's novel, but some people might feel a little surprised that that's still considered new.
Yeah, it shouldn't be considered new, I don't think. And you know, the thing is, most of my books are about the romance, right? It's not really about examining, you know, the issues that interracial or cross-cultural relationships have. It's about, you know, two people coming together regardless of what their background might be. And it's about the core sort of relationship at the heart of the story. But yeah, no, it is. I was actually, you know, sort of on par with this. I was reading this, the Vanity Fair cover article that for Lena Waithe that just came out recently. And Ava DuVernay was interviewed in it, too. And somebody said, you know, is this the moment? Like, is this it? Like, you know, all of this is getting buzz. Like, there's Black-ish and there's Black Panther. And, you know, like, is this it? And she said, you know, I don't know if this is the moment. There have been moments before, and they haven't turned into that. You know, like, they haven't been, like, mission accomplished or anything like that. So it does feel like I'm getting, like, buzz for this, or, like, buzz for who I am or whatever. But at the end of the day, you know, it's not really mission accomplished, and it shouldn't be. This is just sort of the start. This fight's been going on for years and years and years. I mean, you know, all these authors who have come before me as well. And so, and they had their moments too. So I think, you know, if this is sort of going to be, you know, the thing that tips it over, where authors don't have to hide their race to get published, where people will pick up a book no matter who's on the cover. I mean, that sort of as time will tell, and I hope it's this. Like, I hope it's the moment right now.
What is it about doing that in the romance genre that feels particular to you, or sort of like that? Just what you're doing culturally is maybe takes on its own special significance because you're dealing specifically with romance.
I mean, I think the unique thing about romance is that it is a primarily women-driven genre. And that's not to say that we don't have men who write and we don't have men who read. I have a number of male readers, and they're great. But it is, you know, it's made up mostly of women, majority women, and that includes the editors and publishing and everything, the industry itself. And so I think, you know, and somebody said to me, well, don't you think this is better because women understand sort of a struggle, right? Like they know what the struggle is. And I say, you know, I haven't seen the evidence that it's better because in a lot of ways, I mean, we have sort of our own version of the Oscars. It's called the Ritas. And I can count on one hand the number of women of color who have been nominated this year. And it's the same for every year before that. And, you know, I can count on one hand who have won. So we do have an issue with, you know, marginalized people and inclusivity in here, just like Hollywood does, just like science fiction does, just like, you know, all these other places do too. And they're all sort of having their little moments right now. And hopefully, I mean, the idea is, you know, it'll cause a storm and it'll sort of break those floodgates open and it'll equalize at some point.
You know, when you do bring together people of different races and different backgrounds and different cultures, do you think about the history of how that's been done or how that hasn't been done in pop culture, in the arts, in literature?
Oh, for sure. You know, I think the main thing for me is that I assume whoever I'm writing about is reading the book, and I don't want to hurt them. And I know other ways that, you know, marginalized people have been hurt in the past.
Like what?
And if, let's just talk about, like, stereotypical, you know, sort of roles for, you know, South Asians in general. I mean, you've heard about the Apus and the, you know, cab drivers and the whatever, you know, like we have had certain roles that we've been required to fill. They're rarely the main role. They're usually a sidekick or a best friend, if that. and they don't usually get sort of their moment to shine or their moment as, you know, part of the main person. And they have maybe stereotypical jobs or families or whatever. And sometimes those stereotypes do hurt. Like they do, you know, if you hear them enough times. I can tell you, like, I grew up on Indiana, you know, Indiana Jones, and that stupid monkey brain scene has like haunted my childhood because I got made fun of for that. I mean, and it, you know, maybe they didn't intend for that to happen, but that's what happened. And so, you know, I'm very sort of cognizant of that when I'm writing. And I either try to, you know, subvert it or I try to, you know, I try to do anything in a way where I'm like, if the person is reading my book, who is represented by whatever I'm writing, I don't want to add to whatever pain, you know, is sort of going on with them from other things, from people who maybe didn't really care about that.
Do you think that the way that the interracial relationships have been portrayed to now, up until now, has been either flawed or in some way just not enough of it?
I think not enough of it. And I think part of that is because it's been, you know, so many authors have been shut out. I think, you know, of course there's been, you know, there's books that I read and I'm like, oof, like I wouldn't have done that. Or, you know, like, oh, that was a little hurtful or something like that.
What are some of the sort of pitfalls, would you say?
I think one of the main pitfalls for me is just sort of falling into that stereotype. And you know, I was reading, I won't go into what I was reading, but you know, like it's just speaking in general terms, it's very easy, I think, when you've been told a certain thing about a group of people and you don't know anyone from that group of people, and you don't have anybody read for you, or, you know, you're not friends with anyone. It's very easy to just sort of say, well, like, this is what I've seen all my life on TV or movies. And so, you know, if I'm going to write like this, let's say, South Asian character, yeah, I'm going to like make her dad a cab driver and make him really mean or like whatever, you know, like it's going to be like that. And so I think part of the pitfalls is just not maybe taking what you've been told all your life and putting it in your book and thinking this is what reality is, when sometimes you have to understand that the things that have been written and been on TV or, you know, before haven't been written by that dominant group. Or bitten by that minority group before. So, yeah, I just think those are some of the pitfalls. It's just, you know, watch sort of what ism have you internalized from your life and what, you know, what have you put out in your writing and how careful are you to make sure that you're subverting that?
Is there somewhere it still feels taboo to go in terms of race and romance that you still want to go, perhaps?
You know, I think there's, you know, I think part of it is I always ask myself, like, should I be the one writing this? Like, is this the book that I need to write? And because there's nothing really that says that I can't write something, right? There's nothing that says anybody can't write whatever they want. I think the question is, should you write it? Do you feel competent to write it? And that's something like, you know, I'm also a lawyer. And so I've, you know, competence is a legal, you know, standard that we have. Is, are you competent to represent this client? Do you feel capable of doing it? And if you're not, you shouldn't. So I think the same is for writing. Are you competent to write this? If you are, then go for it.
Huh. Any hints about what you do have coming up for your fans?
I do, actually. I'm working on hopefully a series that's sort of a spinoff from my current Forbidden Hearts series, but I'll have more details on that later once it's more finalized.
Cool. Well, our time is up. Alicia Rye, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
Alicia's a romance novelist. She'll be one of the panelists this coming Saturday at the KC KissCon. That'll be from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Woodneath branch of the Mid-Continent Public Library this Saturday. And you can listen back to both of our conversations this morning on Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it all ready for you shortly after the show. That is kcur.org/Central Standard. Keep talking to us about South Kansas City on Twitter, how it's changing or not. Our Twitter handle is at KCURCST. Tomorrow, the local mother-son duo known as Madison Ward and the Mama Bear will be here in studio with us to talk about their new single, and you won't want to miss that. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.